Big Adventures with Brian Durker is supported by Cloud Chaser Creative and Humphrey Summit Ski. Humphrey Summit Ski has been supplying Flagstaff and the surrounding area with quality ski and snowboard equipment for the last 40 years. Humphrey Summit Ski offers quality service, repairs, boot fitting, and more, all from the friendliest staff in Arizona, on the corner of Beaver and Elm, and in Grand Canyon Spirits on Humphrey Street in Flagstaff.
Hi everyone, welcome to Big Adventures. With me, I'm Brian Durker. I'm a boatman in Grand Canyon and have been for the last 50 years. And along the way, I have met the most remarkable personalities and storytellers that I've met anywhere else on the planet. So our intention here is to introduce you to these personalities and hear their stories. And we will learn about the place, the private sector, the commercial sector of boating in Grand Canyon, as well as a tremendous amount of science and administrative interests that might come along the way as far as this great national treasure. So welcome and settle in. I'm thrilled at the fact that my next guest is a guy named Bart Henderson. Bart's an old friend of mine. He started way back in the early 70s being a boatman in Grand Canyon, just like I did. And I've known him through a lot of amazing experiences in Grand Canyon. But Bart has taken it many steps further than Grand Canyon in regards to river running. And he's on the ground floor of the Sobeck, which is the first real big international outfitter, taking people all over the world and doing exploratories all over the world. And he also is just retired from a Alaska river operation that he did quite well with out of Haines, Alaska. And, oh, he's got a remarkable story. I'm excited to introduce to you Bart Henderson. Bart, it's great to see you. I haven't seen you for a while. What have you been up to just as of recently here? Where have you been?
Whatever I want to.
I know. You're retired. You bastard.
Yeah, that's my whole mission in life now is to figure out what's the most fun thing to do next.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Well, just for the listener's knowledge, Bart's, how many times have you been around the world now? I remember the first time you circumnavigated the globe, but you've been around the world several times.
Oh, yeah. I really haven't kept count, but yeah, still traveling.
What's the latest highlight of where you've been?
Oh, let's see. The last really fun trip I thought was Namibia.
Oh, you made it into Namibia.
Yeah, I went over and spent 3 weeks just driving around Namibia. And
did you see the desert elephants?
Yeah. It's really cool. It's sort of like, it's kind of like driving around Sedona, only with elephants.
Amazing.
I mean, the beautiful red rocks and sandstone cliffs and
pretty low country. Population in Namibia, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes you drive for hours and you never see another car. And first thing a car comes by, you wave to them. It's kind of like being
how
in Alaska.
How long were you over there?
3 to 4 weeks. I can't remember exactly how long we were there. But
awesome.
Went out, climbed the world's tallest sand dune and in the Namib Park there. And it's beautiful sand dunes there. Amazing desert country. And then went up to the Etosha Game Reserve and drove ourselves around. And
I've always wanted to go to Namibia. I've been in Botswana and some of those countries adjacent, but I've never made it over there. I'd really like to go.
Yeah,
did you start out
place.
In South Africa? Or
no, we flew right into Windhoek.
Windhoek, okay,
the capital.
Cool. Well, you know, we could go on and on in reverse order as to what your latest adventures have been. But, let's start out in Vernal.
Okay.
Give us a little bit of your background as far as where you grew up and talk a little bit about Royal and just your early days.
Well, growing up in Vernal, my dad was a contractor. And He, in his building trade there, he hired carpenters and laborers, and his main carpenter, his main foreman on his projects was a guy named Cecil Massey. And Cecil Massey was one of the early Hatch's probably most senior guide. And he and Glade Ross were sort of Hatch's guys. And Cecil was a close friend of my dad's. And so because he was the foreman and because he was a boatman, he hired his boatman friends.
Yeah, some things never change, huh?
Yeah. And so I grew up in, you know, in the 50s and the 60s, listening to all these stories about Grand Canyon and Cataract Canyon and the Yampa and Lodore and Desolation and the whole Colorado system, really, because that's where Hatch ran trips, you know. But just listen to those stories. It's like I'd like to say to people, when I was growing up, all my heroes were boatmen, you know, these guys, and I'd just sit around wide-eyed, listen to them tell their stories. And then as I started to get older, I figured, well, as soon as I can, I'm going to just get a job working on the river somewhere, you know. So, but the family rule was kind of 12 years old or so. You're not going on the river till you're at least 12. And so I started rafting about the time I was 12 with my dad and his friends. And then, like I said, in 69, when I graduated from high school, I started working on it, and pretty much all I've ever done since.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. And there was a whole list of guys that are pretty famous.
Well, Vernal, you know, and Hatch was sort of, that was kind of the basis of it all.
Right. It really was.
And I found that actually later in life, that my Uncle Chuck, who was my dad's older brother, was with Bus Hatch on his very first trip.
Oh, wow. Is that right? The Dusty Dozen?
Yeah.
Or whatever it was?
Yeah, those guys. Chuck and Bus Hatch were close friends. And that first trip, I think, was Chuck and Bus and the sheriff at the time there. I believe his name was Hap Swain. And my uncle told me a story about that trip. He was about 90 when he told me the story. And I was just like flabbergasted at that. You know, here I've been in this river business so long, and I had no idea that he was on that very first trip.
Yeah, that's remarkable.
He told me the story about a kid that came into town looking for work, and Chuck owned the gas station in the main square in town. And he put this kid to work because this kid was looking to make some money to buy food so he could get on down the river, because he had gone to Green River, Wyoming to build a boat and take some guy who wanted to retrace Powell's expedition from Green River, Wyoming down. And so the kid went up and built the boat, and then the guy backed out. And the kid had no recourse, no way to get home to Mexican Hat without going down the river. So he just launched his boat and set off down the river and pulled into Jensen and tied up his boat and walked into Vernal and hit my Uncle Chuck up for a job. And Chuck said he got fascinated with the kid's story, and they took Chuck's Model A truck and went out to check out the boat, and the kid took him for a little row around
the
boat.
How cool is that?
And so Chuck told, you know, his buddies about it, and they got all excited. And so they decided to buy the boat and help the kid, get the kid down to overland to get home so he wouldn't have to row the boat home.
How cool
and
is
that's
that?
The boat that they used for that first trip. And they took the boat through the back of Chuck's truck and drove up to above Split Mountain and put the boat in on the river there and floated from Rainbow Park down through Split Mountain. And he was telling this funny story about how the sheriff was with him. And so they wanted to stop and scout the rapids, but they couldn't because there were these guys with guns along the shore. And then they realized they were all moonshiners out there. So they just had to crash on down through the rapids because they didn't want to stop. They had the sheriff with them, and these guys have guns, and the sheriff's ducking down, and they're flooding down. It was a pretty funny story.
Yeah, no kidding. The Wild West right there. Huh?
And I was just amazed at the story that I'd never heard this story. It's in my family, you know, and I don't know why. I said, Chuck, why have you never told me this story? And he said, you never asked.
And he was like 90 years old.
He was almost 90 then. And a few years later, I was down in Flagstaff here, and I told Brad Demick about the thing. And Brad was like fascinated with the story, but it didn't jive and still doesn't jive with a lot of the stories that are published about those first trip.
With
Bus. And Bus is gone. And so I said, well, I'll ask Chuck. He's still alive. And so I was in Vernal, not too much later. And I went over and I said, Chuck, I need to, tell me a little bit more about that first trip. And he looked at me and like, God, it sounds familiar, but.
But you'd already lost Chuck, huh?
So I never got to hear the story again. Or
well, that's why I'm talking to you right now, because it's before we lose your mind.
Exactly. Which I hope is a long ways away.
You never know. You're looking pretty good. You're all right. And so then you got out of high school, started being a boatman, started running some of those upper stretches. When was your first downriver, down Grand Canyon trip? It was with Hatch, wasn't it?
Yeah. My first Grand Canyon trip, let's see, it was the last trip, I think, in 1970. And the Sierra Club had put up some money and some manpower to go down and pick up garbage in the canyon. And so Hatch donated a couple of boats, and Western had a boat, and Whitewater.
And I don't know if we saw you, but that was, we were doing the same thing, Grand Canyon Youth. We were picking up.
I think that was the next year, maybe.
The next year, I think, is the first time I saw you.
In that year, 1970. Hatch needed an extra boatman. They had a big trip going down Lador, and it turned out to be a prep school, a girls' prep school out of Denver.
Of course.
Because I'm only 18 years old myself. So those prep school girls, anyway, I figured, maybe this guiding thing is going to be really
good. It just might be a place for you. And then, so you did that for a pretty good while. And then where'd you go from Hatch? I'm trying to remember.
Well, the next year I started running up in Utah, started the springtime. I started running Green and Yampa trips for Hatch. And then I got a chance to go down and run a training trip, my second training trip. And then I told Ted, I said, no, Ted, I don't want to run on the Green and the Yampa anymore. I need to be down here. And he goes, well, I don't have a space for you down there. And I go, well, if you do, let me know, but I'll be down here.
This is where I'm going to be.
Yeah, and then I met Tom Moody and Pete and Breck. And
The AR boys.
And Fred Burke needed a boatman to run with Tom Moody.
Boom. And those were the good old days there at Vermilion Cliffs. And just for the listener, Vermilion Cliffs is a little outpost there. About 7 miles up the road from Lee's Ferry. And there's a lot of boatmen that went through there and lived in those little apartments. And it was a sanctuary for all boatmen, but a lot of crazy things happened there.
And the local bar.
And it was a bar. And Fred Burke, who was a very colorful character, and his wife, Carol, owned the place. And so it was a real sanctuary for all of us would meet there, no matter what company you worked for, and spend some time at that bar. I was just a kid, but I remember being sent into that bar by Don Neff, who's another another one I'm going to get on on this little show. And he'd send me in and he'd hand me a $20 bill and tell me to go get a six-pack. And so I'd go in and Fred would be behind the bar and he'd give me a six-pack, but he never gave me any change. And so I went back to Don with a six-pack and I go, you know, he's not giving me any change for that six-pack. And, you know, like I'm 14 years old or something. And Don goes, don't worry about the change. But no, that was a great, great center of the universe there, that Vermilion Cliffs.
Yeah, it was.
And then you went along. Did you do anything with Wilderness World? You did a few, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when they first started.
You were a little bit more involved there, yeah.
Yeah, because everything else was running motors after that point.
Right.
And then Wilderness World showed up in rowing boats. And I'm like, yeah, now that's what I want to do.
Yeah, we were rowing Wilderness World and then Oars came in and Outdoors Unlimited. Those were the last two permits to be passed out.
I remember I was on a trip with Joe Townsmeyer and I doing a two boat trip. And we were hiking in Havasu. And a ragtag bunch of people came up. We thought they were a private trip or something, you know, and there weren't very many private trips around in those days. And so we kind of said hi to them and they were kind of standoffish and kind of zoomed on by us and headed up the river and had their sleeping bags and camping gear with them. And we're like, oh, that's kind of wild, but you know, whatever. And we got down to the river and there was this pile of boats down there. They were those old military surplus boats. They weren't even 10 mans. They were like these what we used to call basket boats.
Right.
That had the hoops that went up over there.
And they had the kind of the double chamber around the top and stuff like that.
And they had oarlocks that were, I think they were like 4x4s, chunks of 4x4, like about a 12-inch chunk of a 4x4. With a pipe sticking out of it and patch material, you know.
Some guys use tire rubber outside of them. You
know. But they had them, they had the 4x4s were just glued to the boat.
And anyway, they were no frame. That's right. Like, I remember that.
They were just glued on there. And
that was a Georgie style did that too.
Yeah. That was, it was a wild looking. Did Joe, I remember Joe and I sitting there looking at these rigs, just laughing, going, oh my God, they say Oars on them. It must be a commercial company. Yeah. We never heard of it.
Oars. Yeah.
And that was pretty funny.
And then, so Bart, Grand Canyon and river running was kind of a segue to the next phase in your river career, which is a remarkable story in its own right, is your whole international...
The Sobek scene.
Sobek scene. Yeah, you want to talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, from the Hatch days, I'd gotten to be really good friends with Rich Bangs. And so in 1973, Rich had planned to go explore the Omo River in Ethiopia. And...
And this is a true adventure, by the way, a big adventure.
Yeah, in 1973, so Rich asked me if I wanted to come. He and his buddy John Yost had decided that they wanted to make a commercial venture out of it and do commercial trips in Ethiopia, and so they invited me to come along as a boatman, and we went over in 73 and did the second descent of the Omo, and we explored some other rivers. Our very first trip was a river called the Gaba, which didn't work out so well. We ended up losing all of our boats, and one of our friends drowned on that trip, and it was a real learning experience for us all. And then we
lost all your boats and one of your men. That's what we call a learning experience.
That's a big adventure. You know, hiking out of the jungle.
Go into a little detail on the Gaba.
It's a very small, very steep mountain river that flows down into a little village called. It floats out into a village called Gambela, and so. Rich had spotted it on a map and decided it'd be good. And so he told me, he said, well, if you just show up early, we'll go out and explore. We'll go out and check out the river before everybody gets here. And we'll go have a look, eyes on the river just to see it. Cause up to that point, it was just a line on a map. And so I showed up in Addis, and tracked Rich down which was a story in itself, but I finally tracked him down. And when I finally found him, he goes, okay, I got two tickets on a bus tonight. And it's really kind of 3 a.m. or something like that. This bus leaves and it'll get us out tomorrow to the river and we'll jump off and we'll just camp along the river and just kind of walk down and see what we can see about the river and then catch the bus coming back the next day. And so I said, okay, that sounds fun. So I've just barely landed in Africa for the first time, you know, and in 1973, I think that would make me 22 years old.
Yeah.
Rich was 23, I think. I think he's about a year older than me. And so really just kind of a couple of kids and with a wild notion and some wild ambition. And so we go out to the bus driver is like looking at us and going, I can't just drop you off out here. There's tigers out there, or there's lions out here, you know, and we're like, no, this is the jungle. There's no lions out here. You know, we're not worried about it. But it turns out a lion is just kind of a general term for any big cats. And it turns out there really are big cats out there.
Oh my God.
But anyway, he drops us off and we spend the afternoon trying to walk down the river, and it's just dense jungle and you really can't get very far. So I think we were able to, you know, put eyes on about the first mile. But in that first mile, there was this place where the river went through this little S turn of a gorge that was barely big enough to, you couldn't really float straight down it in places and have your oars out. So you had to kind of have about a 45 degree angle and just keep working yourself in the current and keep from bouncing off the walls. And at the end of this wild S turn was this drop over about a 10 foot waterfall. But it had a tongue that went through it. But on the left, this tongue kind of went in and turned into a rooster tail. If you stayed right on top of it, you'd just go right up over the rooster tail and you'd be out. That was the object. And that's what made it runnable, look runnable. But if you got on the left, it was like a rooster tail. So they'd just like flip you right into the wall. And on the right, it dropped into a huge hole between the pour over and this boulder that was 50, 70 feet in diameter, the giant piece of rock,
boulder.
You know, and this giant hole between the waterfall and this solid rock face. And it looked like sure death if you went in that place, you know. And so I said, well, I think we should portage to this one, Rich. And then, you know, then at least we're here. We can go down to the next place and just make our way down and portage around what needs. And Rich looks at it and he goes, no, it's runnable. It's runnable. I can see there's that run. I go, yeah, I see the run too, but I don't think I could hit that every time. You know, I could probably make it two out of three times, but if we got three boats and everybody rows like me, that means one of us is probably going to flip and we don't really know what's around the corner because we can't walk any farther to see what's downstream. He goes, oh, well, yeah. And so everybody else gets there a few days later. We get everything ready and get out to the river and everybody's excited and we're rigging the boats. Let's go down and look at that place because I'm not sure we should rig our boats totally here because I think we're going to be portaging just right down here. And everybody's excited about rigging the boats and get the boats all rigged. And then we go down and look at it and everybody's scratching their head and everybody could see the run. And we've all come so far to run this trip. It was just to start off with a portage was just more than
you were, mind was fixed on.
I guess so, you know. And I remember I was voting for that we portage this thing, but we didn't. And we flipped two of the three boats. And Rich's boat was first. He flipped to the left into the wall. And I went into the place that I thought was sure death and flipped and had a wild thrashing in there. And then Jim Slade, who was in the middle, I was the sweep boat, Rich was first. Slade went through and hit the slot. The tail waves coming out of the slot went down, and you had to make a sharp left corner into who knows where, because that's as far as we could see.
You couldn't see it.
But there was a log jam at the end of this tail waves. And so Slade had come through. He'd made it through right side up. Not sure he had both oars in the oar locks by then, but got swept right up onto the log jam. And so he's high side, and they're all kind of high side dealing with this. When I finally pop up, and my boat and Gary Mercado and Lou Greenwald were also in my boat, and they had my boat and Lou and Gary had swept past them, so they kind of thought everything was gone. And then I came out of this washing machine finally, and then I remember when I finally came up out of the water after being underwater for a long time and just gasping for breath. And first thing I see, I'm coming down this steep wave, and I'm headed right towards Slade's his wrapped boat. You know, it's wrapped on this log jam, and I still to this day, at that image of that first sight and that realization, I'm either in that boat and alive, or I'm under that boat and in the log jam and dead.
Yeah, simple and, as that.
And right then, Slade happens to be looking up and sees me. And he just sticks his arm out to point to the other guys to say, look, you know, there's Bart. And his arm's out there pointing at me, and I just came right up his arm and into the boat.
I've heard that story, and that's fantastic you got
and,
there.
And we worked the boat off and started gathering everybody up. And then, but Angus McLeod, one of the guys with us, was not to be found. And now we've got just one boat. And everybody on the trip, I think there were maybe 12 of us or 10 of us.
Oh, wow.
Nine or 10 of us. I think there were about three per boat, maybe in three boats. And so we obviously all couldn't go on. And I somehow in the process, I had really just really, not really broken my ankle, but it was severely sprained. And there were a bunch of other bumps and bruises and pretty bad contusions. And so some of us hiked out, and Rich and John and Lou and Gary Mercado and Slade took the one boat and went downstream. And I kind of gathered up everybody else, and we hiked up through the jungle. And so, you know, when I came out, when we finally made it up to the road, I had on a pair of jungle boots and a pair of shorts, no shirt, and a life jacket. And in the wilds of Ethiopia, no money, no passport.
Oh, wow.
No, nothing but just a pair of shorts and a life jacket. I don't even have a shirt.
Oh, my goodness.
It was quite the affair.
And then
they went on downstream a ways, and they didn't flip, but they wrapped once and got off and went into another big nasty spot and wrapped again. And in the process, Gary Mercado dislocated his shoulder. Then Gary and Lou, and it's getting late in the day by now. It's pretty late in the afternoon. And so Gary, Lou Greenwald goes with him to help him. And Gary's arm is stuck up like this. He can't get it down. They can't do anything. He's got his hand kind of on the top of his head. So they got to climb up out of this gorge to where the road is. And they got up till it was just pitch black. And they hadn't gotten to the road, and they didn't know where the road was and how much further they might have to go. And because none of us had ever been on that part of the road.
Oh, wow.
We just knew it was up there somewhere.
Whoa.
And
whoa.
So they finally stopped and decided they're just going to have to sit it out in the jungle there in the night. And they're sitting there, and all of a sudden they hear a bus. They hear a vehicle coming, you know. And it's getting closer and closer, and then they see the lights, and they realize that they're only about 50 feet from the road. And so The jungle's pretty dense there. So Lou jumps up and scurries to the road and flags this. And it's the bus that had dropped us off earlier in the day on its way back to Addis. And so the bus picks him up. And we had caught a ride with a truck and it jumped up on the big load of a lorry and made our way back to the closest village. And so we were there in a Buna Bait, the little coffee house slash restaurant slash hotel that they have in all the little villages. And so we're staying in this little Buna Bait, and in the middle of the night, there's somebody pounding on the door. And so I get up and come out. Gary and Lou are out there, and Lou carries on the floor and his arm's all dislocated. So we had a doctor with us, George Fuller, who became our sort of expedition doctor for almost all of our early trips. And he and I relocated Gary's shoulder right there on the floor, did a little bit of whiskey and to ease the pain, and gave it some big tugs, and we finally got it in. But George was good. He knew how to do it, and he taught me to be his assistant. And so
it was incredible. Those guys. That's an African adventure right there. Now, while you were still over there, did you go, what was it, the Omo?
Well, the next day, Rich and John and Slade lost the boat in a flip, and the boat disappeared and they hiked out. And we all got back together in this little town and licked our wounds as much as we could and headed back to Addis and tried to deal with it. But, finally, we talked the government into allowing us to fly the river to look for Angus. And in the process, we spotted the boats, and all three boats were wrapped on the same big boulder in the river. So we figured out where it was, and we went and took about 50 porters and some locals and went down to the river and got the boats off the rock and came back and took them into Addis. And of course, all the oars were gone. And the boats were just thrashed. They were the old Holcomb Abyss.
The old Holcomb,
that, was made out of ripstop nylon coated with, a PVC material.
Coated with hope.
Yeah. And they'd thrashed on the rocks so long that the air just kind of seeped out of the boats, but we patched them up as much as we could. And George Wendt sent us another boat. And, so we took these three boats. And my boat had over 200 patches on it. It was just complete. And mine held air fairly good, and Slade's held air pretty good. But Richard John's boat, when we set off on the Omo, it was holding air. But by halfway down the river, it was not doing so well. But George sent another boat over, and we had a local lathe guy turned some oars for us out of the best wood that they had. And it was Wanza wood. This is the strongest wood we have in Ethiopia. And they looked really good. But when we got all rigged up, and then, you know, about 3 weeks later or so, we headed off to down to do this first trip down the Omo, and pulling out of the eddy at the put in. My first stroke in the current, boom, snapped an oar right off. I'm like, oh, let's see, we're running 32 days with these oars. We've already lost one out of, what do we have, like 12 or something like that. Yeah, it didn't bode well. But we ended up making it with the oars, but they were pretty iffy.
It was a 30-day trip on the Omo?
Yeah, yeah, whoa. Yeah. I haven't been 32 days.
And then that one became kind of a mainstay for Sobek for years after, yeah. Right? The Omo, yeah. I remember a lot of.
Yeah, we went back and ran it year after year. A lot of years, we were the only only Western foreign travelers in the country, because when we first went in 73, Haile Selassie was still the emperor. And then in 74, late 74, the coup happened and the communist government takeover.
Yeah, moratorium on travel.
And they, it pretty much the only travelers there were Russians and Cubans, except for some reason they let us keep coming and running our trips down in the down that little corner of Ethiopia.
Amazing.
It was a fabulous trip.
Yeah.
I mean, that especially that first trip. I mean, the first trips, every trip down those for those first ones, you're having first contact with people that never seen anything like us.
And then what other African rivers did you guys do, Sobek do over there? It was mainly the Omo, as I recall.
The Omo and then the Kilimanjaro and Rufiji in Tanzania became wow. another one that we did. And that was a wild trip. It was one of those trips that you do it once and you go, I'll never do this again. That's the hardest river trip I've ever done. You know, it was only about a 2-week trip, but in 2 weeks you would see over 5,000 hippos.
Yeah, the hippo fair.
And you spent all day dodging and paddling as hard as you could to get away from hippos chasing you, you know. And I don't think we ever did a trip we didn't have a hippo bite on one of the boats. And lots of close calls. I remember twice on my trips in the on that river having hippos come up under the boat. We were doing paddle trips. So you're standing on the floor of the boat, right? And when a hippo comes up underneath you and you're standing on the floor, you're basically standing on the hippo's back.
On the hippo's back his mouth.
Or his mouth, or worse. But the mouth is coming. The back comes up first, and then the mouth comes up, and then
the only experience I had with that was on the Zambezi in canoes, and mm-hmm. we got chomped by not my canoe, but our party. We lost a canoe to the hippos as well. But that is terrifying.
Terrifying.
They're very territorial, and
that first trip on the Omo, mine was the first boat to ever get bitten.
And, yeah, I recall that.
Mine was I got the first bite, and then we used all of our patching glue, all of the glue that we had and all the patching material to fix that hippo bite. That hippo can do some serious damage to a raft. And we got my boat all back together and floating, and about a week or 10 days later, we got another bite on John Yosu's rowing, and he and Rich, their boat got bitten. Their boat was already hardly holding air, but now we had no glue and no patching material, no way to fix it. So we had to abandon that boat and head on down the river with just three boats.
And then beyond Africa, what other trips were you guys doing on a consistent basis as Sobek?
The Biobío in Chile was one of our mainstays for years and years. I know you got down there, and that was a fantastic trip. And of course, then we started running we went up and explored the Tachinchini and then the Alsek. And so that became, to this day, is still a mainstay. The Choru in Turkey. There was a few rivers in New Guinea, Papua New Guinea. We did exploratories in a bunch of different places, you know. Sobek pioneered did a bunch of first descents around the world.
Yeah, amazing the diversity that Sobek approached. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean,
the cool thing about Sobek to me is that in 1973, rafting was uniquely American experience, and by Sobek taking it international, it really spread the sport of rafting internationally around the world. Now, everywhere you go, there's raft companies and raft trips.
Yeah, no, it really did lay it down.
And in those days, rafting was uniquely American. There really wasn't anywhere else. So we really had this golden age that we were just lucky enough to be alive at the right time and taking that sport and going out and getting to do first descents and see all these wild places. And, you know, virtually every trip that we did, they're all damned. They're all
dams followed. And that's a conversation we could go deep into. But back to Grand Canyon, you know, it's what went on in Grand Canyon and on the Colorado really was the ground floor.
Yeah.
of all those different people that spread their wings to those other continents for the river.
It was always the Grand Canyon is always the one that everything gets compared to.
Yeah, and it still does. Yeah.
Rapids, the biggest rapid on the river was always Lava North, Lava South, Lava East.
Yeah, no, it is. You guys named a bunch of stuff. It seems like every river I've gone on, you guys named some places on it. Now, you guys really got your feet solid there in Alaska. And as time went on, you started your own company. In Alaska, and a few other of our friends, Mark Jensen and a few other guys, started small companies up there and stuff. But tell us about your Alaska operation.
Well, we went up first and explored the Taut in 76 and just fell in love with it and decided that that would be a great Sobek trip. So it's kind of a natural part of the ecosystem of Glacier Bay National Monument, so or Glacier Bay National Park. So they annexed it into Glacier Bay, and then it became a Park Service control, and they decided to give out permits. And so they gave me a permit because I had led the first exploratory trip in 76. So they gave me a permit, and I had actually started a little daily business in Haines as a social experiment in the town because the logging mills had all just shut down and the town was in a depression and searching for something to do. And I started Chilkat Guides is the name of it, just as a sort of a show to say, you know, hey, tourism is a way that, that you can make a living. You can build an economy around it. And I had been to New Zealand and I'd seen how, like in Queenstown, how a town that's got so much natural beauty and a variety of stuff to do had really made a living out of just where they are and how cool it is. And I, that was kind of the vision that I had for Haines, was that adventure tourism would be a really Haines, the most
perfect
logical place,
place
ever for
perfect
it.
Place.
Got the ocean, I got the big mountains, you got skiing, you got rafting, you got hiking, you got mountaineering and glaciers and ice climbing and just, you know, whatever you want. I mean, it's, that's all right there, and fishing and hunting. And so, I started this company and I just stayed on the river. I hired a guide and bought a boat and we didn't even have a truck to start with. And, that first year, this gal that I'd hired to be my guide, and she had to have a real job to be able to live there and feed herself. But, she got a job in a record store and a little Whole Foods, a little health food store. And so she'd get a couple of people and sign up for a trip and she'd go find one of our friends that had a pickup truck and they'd load the gear in the back and she'd jump in the back and put the clients in the front with the guys in the pickup truck and they'd drive them up and she'd rig the boat right on the river there and then float down all day. And then the truck would come pick them up and de-rig the boat and put it in the back of the
truck.
And
great old school.
Old school stuff. And I think we took 20 people, 20 or 25 people the first year. And then it just built from there and built and built and built. And by the time I sold it, we were taking over 45,000 people a year on trips.
Unreal. And you got involved with the tour boats as well. And I mean, you
cruise
got
ships.
Involved with pretty much every aspect of the economy there in Haines. And if you guys that are listening ever have a chance to go to Haines, it's a wonderfully beautiful, awesome experience. I recommend it to everybody. But but you're still living up there?
Yep. Yeah. I still have part ownership of a whale watching company out of Juneau that we operate, but I don't really have any operational duties there.
You don't have any stake in the day to day.
Yeah. Yeah. I just help. It was sort of one of my ideas and we got it started and
Well, we're kind of running out of time and once again, it's going to be good to get you back.
Because
the old number one had stacked up more travel and adventures between now and then. But I haven't got just a couple questions. With your perspective on the impact of adventure and the impact of the natural world in your life, and it goes without saying it's had a profound effect on you as a person. What do you think the outlook on saving some of this wildlands and adventure for the future generations? Is it as dismal as it sometimes seems, or
I don't think so.
What's your take on it?
You know, I love having had the opportunity to see these rivers in their, you know, when we had them to ourselves. I mean, it was an amazing experience, but it's still an amazing, like, I'm headed tomorrow to go do my 110th Grand Canyon trip. And, you know, nowadays there's people all over the place and, you know, millions of people that have been down there, and it's still a phenomenal place, you know? And I think that, you know, it's important that we, especially those of us who've been around a long time, sort of open our mind to that it's a big world, and the more people get out and do these adventures, and the more they get out, the more chance there is to save stuff, because you build a constituency for it, a political constituency that is willing to stand up and fight for the survival of wilderness areas and wild places and adventure travel and stuff. And there will always be this struggle to find a balance between letting enough people go down the river or into the wilderness or whatever the adventure is, and not overrunning it and making too many so that you destroy the experience or you destroy the place. But, you know, I've been around this agencies trying to figure out the logic behind how they're going to manage that, you know, that balance. And everybody comes at it a little bit differently. None of them that I know of have really come to it in much of a logical way. It's just kind of stumble into it. Whatever they come up with, that's what it gets stuck at. And usually just whatever it was when they entered the game, we're just going to limit it to that. But, you know, if you're managing it to protect the wilderness experience, you have to remember that wilderness experience is like in the eye of the beholder. It's like everybody's wilderness experience is different. There are no two wilderness experiences are the same. So how do you manage to say, we want to protect the wilderness experience? I mean, we all want to do that, just theoretically, but you have to sympathize with the guys that got to make the decisions, because whose wilderness experience, at what level, you know, the people that we take down the river, their experience of wilderness experience is way lower than you or I, who have, you know, had these wild wilderness experiences in places where we're way out there all by ourselves. And so our expectations of a wilderness experience are vastly different than most of the clients that we take down the rivers nowadays.
And beyond that, those experiences that the river runners are having is far different than somebody's experience getting out of a tour bus and being able to at least touch a little bit of that perimeter of wilderness and stuff.
And so it'll always be a dilemma. I think the most important thing is that we are protecting blocks of land and hopefully ecosystems. You know, we're trying, if we're going to set up a park, we kind of incorporate the whole ecosystem so that, you know, not just like trying to save a little piece of it, but the encroachment around it is draining toxins into it at such a rate that it all disappears. So I think that in general, if you look around the world, in the United States, we're doing a better job than most.
And, you know, I agree. I think what worries me is the pendulum swinging back and forth between administrations and the powers that be. You see one governing group really prioritize protectionism, and then you see that taken away depending on the pendulum and which side of that you're on.
Right.
And that's of great concern, I think, to most of us that have thrived on life being so much a part of adventure and vice versa.
Yeah.
But I can't thank you enough for the time we've spent here, and I really look forward to another visit with you, Bart.
Oh, good.
But I do appreciate your insights on how important it is for people to get out there and take advantage of these places and use the resources like outfitters and stuff that, number one, they show you a good, safe way to see it, but they also are that core group that are helping protect these resources and these places and these ecosystems and such. But your insight is valuable, I think, to all of us with your lifelong experience with both ends of that spectrum and stuff. But I love you. I've known you forever. I look forward to our next visit.
Thanks, all right. All right. Good luck on this project.
I'll probably need it. And you guys, thanks for sitting in on this. And all I have to say is stay right side up. This is Big Adventures signing out with Bart Henderson. Thank you.
Big Adventures is produced by Brian Durker, Margaret Knight, and me, Gavin Buchner. Bill Gleckler and his mandolin provide our music. If you like our show, please subscribe on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.